This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Good evening, I'm Matthew Wade. On tonight's edition of The Informer, we'll be speaking with President of Living Positive Victoria, Richard Keane, about this weekend's 33rd International AIDS Candlelight Memorial in Melbourne. The memorial, of course, which is hosted every year, will be centred around a candlelighting ceremony to honour the lives that have been lost and will provide an opportunity for people to hear from young HIV-positive speakers about their journey. We'll also be speaking with the co-convener of the Victorian Gay and Lesbian Rights Lobby, Sean Mulcahy, about the issues the VGLRL plan to campaign for in the lead up to the federal election. On tonight's edition of The Informer, we're taking a look at the 33rd International AIDS Candlelight Memorial in Melbourne, which will be on this Sunday. And right now we're joined in the studio by President of Living Positive Victoria, Richard Keane. Welcome, Richard.
Good evening, guys. How are you doing?
We're doing great, thank you. I was hoping you could tell me to start off with a bit about the theme of this year's Candlelight Memorial, which is, I believe, engage, educate and empower.
Yeah, that's the theme of this year's memorial. And really, the memorial has always been about community engagement right from the very beginning. And that's a theme that we want to continue to carry on throughout the life of this event. And the other two areas are about empowering people through education and through information and community connection.
Definitely. And like you mentioned, you know, engaging, educating and empowering the community, they've always been important. But I guess I was curious to know, with the, you know, the naturally changing landscape of HIV from then to now, at the moment, what are the things we kind of really need to be educating the community on? You know, they might be different than they were perhaps 10 years ago even. Like, what are the main kind of things to educate at the moment?
Okay, there's been quite a transition, as you know, biomedical interventions and things in the prevention area. Also, things like effective treatments has led to a situation where it becomes more difficult for people with an undetectable viral load to pass on HIV to their partners. Mm-hmm. And so these have been major changes in our landscape, particularly in the last 5 years, that have really started to get some traction, with the TGA at the stage now of looking into approval of PrEP at a national level. I think it gives us an opportunity for organisations like Living Positive Victoria to talk about the other part of the equation to reduce HIV infections, which is getting people on treatment early and getting people to have an undetectable viral load.
So at the moment, a big focus is kind of getting people on treatment early. I mean, imagine naturally, more recently, some studies have shown that, you know, a lot of the individual health benefits of going on treatment early that perhaps people weren't aware of beforehand. So is that kind of one of the main things, that one of the messages that I guess Living Positive and I imagine VAC as well are trying to get out?
Yeah, absolutely. And we've been lucky that any previous barriers that were there around accessing treatments, like a certain level of T cells and things like that before you could access treatments, all of those things have been removed. So there's really nothing to stop people from considering treatment upon their diagnosis. So I know that that might seem a little bit funny, and you think people might have some time to adjust and all those sorts of things. All that's important, but those conversations about treatment should start with your GP upon your diagnosis.
Definitely. I imagine back in the day, you know, like you mentioned, there's a certain, for instance, a cell count, you know, that would require you to, like, you should be on treatment. But now that there's more awareness around the benefits of it, do you think there's going to be more more people that are treating early and more people that are adopting it, you know, because they are aware of these kind of things?
Yeah, absolutely. And particularly in the LGBTI community, there has been a really high, knowledge around HIV for quite some time. But we still find that within marginalised communities, and I'm talking about women, heterosexual men, as an example, that we still get a lot of people presenting really late after they test. And sometimes they're already suffering consequences of significant infection.
Definitely. You know, one of the main kind of goals we're trying to achieve at the moment is that 90-90-90 goal by getting there by 2020. And for those who don't know, that is essentially ensuring that 90% of HIV-positive people both know their status and are on treatment, and also 90% of those people that are on treatment have an undetectable viral load. I guess, how do you think we're on track to reaching that at the moment?
I think with the changes that we were just talking about earlier, there's a real possibility. Probably about 3 or 4 years ago, when this terminology was first starting to reach the public forums, even someone who's really highly involved like myself was a bit sceptical about 90-90-90. But we're really lucky and privileged to live in a country where there's no barriers to access, where treatment is available and testing is available, and consistent access to treatment is available as well, which is really, really important. And what was a really, I guess, optimistic target to aim for, I think was within our reach if we work together and keep those conversations going.
Of course. I guess, you know, and you've mentioned, you know, in the last 5 years, you know, there's been massive changes, you know, in the last week or two, and you know, we've seen PrEP, you know, be approved by the TGA, which, and it looks like it's relatively on track to getting subsidized by the PBS later in the year. Do you think this is one of, I guess, the main things that will help us achieve that goal? Like, what do you see as the main things that will help us get there?
I think that's a really important step. And what that does too is it allows HIV negative people to take control of their own sexual health as well in a prevention manner. Whereas historically, there's always been a sort of a waiting onto the responsibility of what the HIV positive person has as part of their role. And that's still there. There is an obligation to reduce chances of infection and
is
things
that like treatment as prevention?
Absolutely.
I guess what else? Yeah, so aside from that idea of informing HIV negative people, getting PrEP more accessible for HIV positive people, is it just about building, you know, educating and building awareness that will help us also reach the goal, just more widespread awareness?
Yeah, absolutely. And really important things around peer support, the stuff that we know has worked throughout the whole of the history of the epidemic. And it's been that peer support, that linking in social isolation and other issues create a real problem. And the idea of some of the programs we run, like Phoenix workshops for newly diagnosed people living with HIV, our Speakers Bureau, and we've got two fantastic young speakers who'll be speaking at the vigil this week who've come through our Speakers Bureau at Living Positive Victoria, and I'm really looking forward to hear them speak. They have a huge impact, and I think one of the important things about this event remaining is historically, originally it was a way to come together and grieve, and before effective treatments were available, we were in a situation where we were just losing hundreds and hundreds of people. I myself lost a partner when I was younger and lost a number of close friends, and so historically the event has a different meaning for me, and it's that continual remembrance. But also too, there's a lot of hope around now. There's a lot of hope around extended well-being and living relatively productive, fully participatory lives.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned the difference, like how it's changed over time. You know, some of the people, some of the younger people that might be, for instance, attending the memorial, they may not have been around when, you know, people were passing away quite rapidly. So for them, I guess, what does the memorial signify? Is it about kind of just raising that awareness and reminding people that, yeah, there's actually quite a big history that's there, you know? Is it kind of, for the people that weren't around then, what does the memorial signify?
Wow. So I think that on a number of levels, it's about engaging with the broader community. Like I was saying, our community has a great amount of knowledge and a great amount of experience and expertise in these areas in a lot of ways. But the general community doesn't have that engagement. And you find as soon as you step outside of our community that there's a real low level of information around HIV/AIDS, and people consider it in this country to be an epidemic that's mostly amongst gay men, which is true, but globally that's not the case at all. And when we take that focus, I think that can be a bit dangerous because it leaves other people vulnerable, particularly people from the heterosexual community, bisexual people who may not think that they're at risk, and they tend to be the people that are presenting late with significant illness.
Exactly, and those people who aren't aware and haven't been educated on HIV or any of that kind of stuff, If they're exposed to, for instance, more stigmatizing language or that, I mean, that would have a negative impact. You know, what role does stigma play in all this, in like the fight towards, you know, ending HIV? Like, how big is that?
That hasn't changed.
Yeah.
Stigma hasn't changed. And that's both external, from the way that other people might react to finding out about your HIV status, or may make a decision that's discriminatory for you in a job or something, and you may not even know about that. But it's also internal. It's about how we see ourselves. And I think part of being on effective treatment is that feeling of a situation that was out of control coming back into your control. You can have control and you can take control over your own well-being and health by accessing effective treatments and adhering to that regime.
definitely. You know, you mentioned earlier that at the memorial there will be a number of, you know, HIV positive speakers that'll be sharing their stories. How important is that in tackling that kind of stigma, you know, getting people's actual personal stories out there for people to, you know, connect with?
Yeah, it's essential and it's a cornerstone of my organisation. Mm-hmm. We see ourselves as a positive voice organisation, and along with our partners in this project, which is Straight Arrows Victoria, Positive Women Victoria, mm-hmm. and Melbourne City Council mm-hmm. also supporting this event, the personal narrative of lived experience has an amazing effect on people. And when I was saying this is in a public forum, so what I love about the Candlelight Memorial currently in the situation is that we get people who aren't even thinking that they're going to come along, and they're just walking down the street. They're there with their families and all of a sudden they see something happening. And it's that engagement when people mm-hmm. come over and they stop what they're doing and they stay for that whole journey mm-hmm. and they hear people's stories, and it really touches that empathetic part of a person where you can really relate.
Of course, and being in such a, like you mentioned, like public space, like in the city, like people who have perhaps weren't even potentially going to visit there will come across it, like you just mentioned.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Richard.
Thanks for having me.
That was Richard Keane, and the 33rd Annual International AIDS Candlelight Memorial will be held this Sunday, the 15th of May at 5 p.m. at the Melbourne City Square. You're listening to The Informer, and if you want to have your say, make sure you send an email to onair@joy.org.au or text the studio on 0427-JOY-949. Up next, we'll be joined by Sean Mulcahy, who will chat with us about the issues the Victorian Gay and Lesbian Rights Lobby plan to focus on in the lead-up to the federal election. This is The Informer on Joy 94.9. You're listening to The Informer, and right now we're joined by co-convener of the Victorian Gay and Lesbian Rights Lobby, Sean Mulcahy, who, along with the New South Wales Gay and Lesbian Rights Lobby, have announced a joint campaign to highlight key issues in the lead-up to the federal election, which was recently announced by Malcolm Turnbull and will take place on July the 2nd. Sean, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on, Matt.
You know, I was reading the campaign outline, and one of the ones you've kind of chosen to focus on are the rights of LGBTI youth, you know, is one of the key issues. I guess for you, what are some of the issues that younger sex and gender diverse people are facing in Australia at the moment?
Well, I think you'd have to have your head in the sand if you weren't aware of the fact that LGBTI young people are increasingly under attack. We've seen the recent attacks on the Safe Schools Coalition. We know it's a program that works, and we know that we need to address the homophobia, biphobia and transphobia that exists in our schools. So we're calling on all parties to make it clear what their program is going to be that's going to address these issues in our schools, not only for LGBTI kids, but also kids in rainbow families with LGBTI parents too. I was just saying that one of the crucial issues we need to address is not only the effects that these attacks have on LGBTI kids, but also on kids with LGBTI parents.
Of course. You know, I mean, here in Victoria, we've seen, like, our state government, you know, Daniel Andrews, they've been quite vocal about supporting Safe Schools and its program for LGBTI students, I guess. How important is it to focus on those younger LGBTI people who don't live here that may be from other states or even more, I guess, regional or rural areas?
Well, we also know statistically that LGBTI people that live outside the 10-kilometre radius of the city have higher rates of mental health issues, including anxiety or depression. And often for LGBTI kids living in regional areas, school is their major hub, you know. It's a major opportunity for them to get together with their peers. And that's why it's so incredibly important that we have safe school environments for kids living in rural and regional areas. And the teachers in those areas are equipped to deal with the issues that LGBTI people face, whether that's through coming out, transitioning, whether it's about finding out about an intersex status.
Of course. You know, I think that as much as discrimination and marginalisation would affect LGBTI people in some way or another of all ages, you know, young people are at their most vulnerable. You know, they're developing their sense of identity. You know, they're in school. That's where they're getting taught about themselves. How important is it? Yeah, for people that are in that stage, you know, having something like Safe Schools or having their identities validated, how important is it for all parties, politically speaking, to get behind?
It's absolutely important. And I know that we've seen the coalition wavering on this, but we did have a commitment from all parties going into the last election around the Safe Schools program. So I'd like to see what the coalition's alternative program is, because we know we need to address this issue. because if we don't address it in our schools, it's going to have repercussions for these kids later in life too.
Definitely. So
the more that we can invest early in creating a safe and supportive environment, it will pay off in future years. If we're looking at it in purely financial terms, it makes sense, let alone the benefits that creating acceptance and equality and understanding has in our school.
Exactly, which is arguably the most important thing of all, you know, having that equality. You know, as part of your campaign outline, I guess you also mentioned the great work that's already been undertaken here in Victoria, again, you know, by our Gender and Sexuality Commissioner, Rowena Allen. And you also kind of mentioned the need to have some sort of national commissioner, you know, on a more national level that can focus on those issues. I guess if we did have that, if the federal government implemented a commissioner for that purpose, what could someone help to achieve in that role?
Well, I think as we've seen here in Victoria with Ro Allen, our Gender and Sexuality Commissioner, it's a real in to government. You know, at a federal level, we have an Age Discrimination Commissioner, a Disability Discrimination Commissioner, a Race Discrimination and Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Social Justice Commissioner. We've got commissioners representing all facets of the diverse Australian community, but we don't have an LGBTI-specific commissioner. We see the great work that Ro's doing here in Victoria, and we think that's a model that can be adopted by federal parties too. It also benefits them because it's streamlining consultation as well too. To have somebody there whose linkage between government and community is absolutely critical. It just makes good sense.
Exactly. And as you mentioned earlier, talking about safe schools again, you know, here in Victoria, the government and Rowena Allen have been big advocates for it. But having a national commissioner, I imagine, wouldn't be as fragmented. You know, there wouldn't be as many kind of, you know, big support in one area and not so much in the other. It would be, like you said, a bit more national, more widespread for a lot of in terms of tackling issues that are specific to LGBTI people.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And it's not just about having a commissioner. Other things we'd like to see too is a whole of government ministerial advisory group. Again, you know, Victoria is leading the way on this in terms of the LGBTI task force, an effective model that could be easily translated into a Commonwealth context. And we'd also like to see all of the parties adopting an equality spokesperson. Again, Victoria is leading the way. But why don't we have a spokesperson for equality at a federal level? Again, we've got ministers for Indigenous affairs, for women's affairs, for multiculturalism. Why is it that the 11% of the population that identifies LGBTI aren't represented in the ministerial lineup of this country?
Exactly. I feel like, you know, Victoria is kicking a lot of goals in relation to LGBTI equality. And, you know, as you're mentioning, on a federal level, we should really be following in the footsteps. I guess lastly, I was going to mention, you know, there's a potential impending plebiscite, and that's also on your agenda. You know, the government put aside $160 million in the budget for it, and 70% of LGBTI Australians are against it, you know, but the government doesn't seem to be taking that into account. How is the VGRL going to address that?
Well, I think it's just time the government ended this tedious debate about a plebiscite. Is it going to be binding? Is it not going to be binding? Is it going to be a compulsory vote? Is it going to be voluntary? Are we going to be funding the yes or no campaigns? It's just such a waste of time having these conversations when we could just be voting on it. And I get the sense that everyday Australians are as sick and tired as most LGBTI people are of having our rights talked about over and over and over and over again, when we could just legislate for this in Parliament. We know we've got the numbers. So I would think that any party that's going to the election should seriously consider whether it wants to be spending this money on a plebiscite. $160 million is only going to cover the base amount. There's going to be more needed to be spent on top of it. And why not save the money and just put it to a vote in Parliament? It's just so simple and straightforward.
And then naturally, as you mentioned earlier, having people's rights debated about will have quite a negative impact or could have a damaging impact on LGBTI Australians, young and older alike.
You're absolutely right. And Drummond Street has come out and said that there has been a spike in accessing its support services amongst LGBTI people, particularly young people, that are really disturbed around the debate that's occurring around the plebiscite. And I won't say it's everyone that's debating quite negatively, but there are sentiments that are particularly harmful to LGBTI young people or people with LGBTI parents. And it's going to be a cost, again, to government, because this spike in accessing services is taking attention from these organisations away from other critical services that they're providing. So, again, we're going to need to see from the government some investment in health and other support services for LGBTI people if there's a plebiscite campaign.
Exactly.
Now, one way to avoid that investment is just simply dump the plebiscite and put it to a vote. And that's what we've been calling for. You said at the outset 70% of LGBTI Australians don't want a plebiscite. I think the government needs to listen to that.
Well, that's it. There's the 70%. Yeah, exactly. There's a 70% statistic proving that. Thank you so much for joining us, Sean.
Thank you very much for having me on.
That was co-convener of the Victorian Gay and Lesbian Rights Lobby, Sean Mulcahy, and you're listening to The Informer on Joy. You're listening to The Informer, and if you want to have your say, send an email to onair@joy.org.au or text the studio on 0427JOY94.9. Up next, you'll hear from Across to Attitude magazine about the biggest LGBTI news today. This is The Informer on JOY94.9.
Joining us in the UK to find out what's happening in the Northern Hemisphere is the web editor for Attitude magazine, Will Stroud. Good morning, Will.
Good morning to you, James. Very nice to speak to you.
Likewise, as always. Now, tell us, there's a fair bit of baking that may not or may have been happening in Northern Ireland and causing some controversy.
Yes, absolutely. Well, this is an update on a sort of an ongoing row in Northern Ireland. It's been a sort of big legal test case for LGBT equality laws here in the UK. And basically, it all started when 2 years ago, almost exactly 2 years ago, next Monday, a gay man named Gareth Lee went to a bakery, Asher's Baking Company in Belfast, and placed an order for a cake with a... actually had a picture of Bert and Ernie from Sesame Street on it with a same-sex marriage slogan. Obviously, you know, the original bromance. Now, the company took the order and paid the money, and then basically reneged and said, actually, we're not going to bake this cake. It's a Christian-run bakery chain. It goes against their beliefs. Obviously, Mr. Lee took them to court, saying this breached equality legislation. Now, actually, last year, a judge did rule that the bakery had been in breach of UK equality legislation and fined the bakery. But today they have actually been gone back to court because they are officially launching an appeal against this decision. Now, the bakery argued that they basically argued that they would have not placed this order for anyone, and Mr. Lee's sexuality was immaterial to their decision, that they wouldn't have baked a cake with a same-sex marriage slogan on it for anyone. And so technically they are not discriminating against a gay person. It's more that the actual content of the cake, which seems to be the issue here.
So really what we're finding out is they actually just really, really dislike Bert and Ernie.
Absolutely. They just don't want Bert and Ernie to be happy. And, you know, a lot of time and money has gone into this. But yeah, it has been a sort of real test case of equality legislation. Obviously, not been a clean cut case, you know, because of the whole sort of grey area surrounding the content of the cake.
I kind of find myself sitting on the fence with this one because I don't actually know where I stand. Like on one side, sure, I don't think anyone should be discriminating against a gay couple or a same sex couple that want to get married. But then on the other hand, I really don't want a homophobe baking my cake anyway.
Well, yeah, this is also the other issue, absolutely. And, you know, obviously it was a sort of politically-minded cake, but, you know, certainly wasn't a wedding cake, which I guess you wouldn't want being made by Asher's Baking Company anyway. That much has been made clear over the last couple of years.
Well, you know, hopefully they just go out of business then, you know. But mind you, I don't think Northern Ireland's getting any closer to marriage equality anyway anytime soon, so I don't think they've got to worry about it.
Well, absolutely. I mean, you know, the more and more of these cases we see coming out of Northern Ireland, sort of more frustrating it gets, you know, for people, you know, Northern Irish people and around the UK. We had the local elections last week, which the Democratic Union Party remain the biggest party in the Northern Ireland Assembly. Yeah. And they're, you know, still vehemently anti-same-sex marriage. So you know, we are really seeing sort of Northern Ireland being ghettoised in terms of, you know, these LGBT rows that keep erupting left, right, and centre.
Unbelievable. And last year there was a huge case involving NHS and sexual health clinic, and some final kind of come downs have come from that.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is someone, last September it was, that had a very bad day at the office at one of London's leading sexual health clinics, 56 Beam Street. It's, you know, in the heart of Soho, you know, with a, you know, lots of members of the London gay community.
It's a wonderful clinic. I've been there several times.
It is. It absolutely is. It's cutting edge, and they do a wonderful job there. But yeah, this was an unfortunate mistake where someone on an email to people had been coming to an HIV clinic. And we've probably all done it at various points, but they didn't blind copy the people into the email, which ended up in basically the email names and email addresses of almost 800 patients being sent to each other, completely visible. And obviously, you know, when people are attending a local clinic, as you can imagine, you know, people know names on that list. And
sure.
A great deal of upset and anguish. You know, obviously the clinic apologised, absolutely mortified, understandably. But they've had the sort of investigation wrap up just today, and it's, you know, despite the fact it's obviously an honest mistake on their behalf, it's, you know, been called a serious breach of the law in terms of the handling of that kind of data. And the NHS Trust that runs the clinic has actually been fined £180,000. For that mistake. So obviously, you know, it's a bit of controversy because it's unlikely any of that, you know, compensation will go to the people involved.
No.
Obviously, a very expensive email. For that poor staff member to have sent last September.
Oh, dear. Well, yeah, sometimes when I get an email that people forget to do the BCC, I really wonder what's wrong with humanity. Thank you so much for this week's update, Will. We will chat to you next week.
No, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you to my guests today, Richard Keane and Sean Mulcahy. Today's head producer was me, with assistance from Bart Vanderwerf and Stephanie McLean. A full rundown on today's story will be on Joy shortly, and for a podcast of today's program and our other stories, visit joy.org.au/theinformer. Up next is Stand Up Straight. I'm Matthew Wade.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.